Acts chapter 27. Acts 27. Now we can take these last two chapters of the book of Acts and caption them under the major theme, Journey to Rome. Starting in chapter 27 and verse 1, and ending with chapter 28 and verse 15, where it says, "And the brethren which they heard about us came from there," that is Rome, "as far as the market of Appius, and three ends to meet us. And when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage." And, verse 16, "When we entered Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who was guarding him." And we'll have a little section then that will finish out the book of Acts. But basically, Journey to Rome, chapter 27 and verse 1 through 28 and verse 15, where Paul arrives in that far western city of Rome. Now, by way of introduction to it, and as a first point, remember, Paul has been in prison for 2 years. And so as we meet him on the way to Rome, Paul is now ending a 2-year imprisonment. And as we open up chapter 27 of the book of Acts, which reads, "And when it was decided," that's after 2 years, "that we should sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius." So he's been there for 2 years. And let me, because of that 2-year period, let me raise some questions, and they're not questions we can answer, but they're well worth thinking about. How was Paul supported during that 2-year imprisonment? Prisoners had to support themselves. They were not supported by the state. He had to support himself. How did he support himself? Felix thought he had money. Acts 24:26 says, as he is in prison, he says Felix visited him often, and at the same time he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore he used to send for him quite often and converse with him. So Felix, the Roman judge, has got the impression that Paul has money. On what basis? We don't know. How were his relationship, was his relationship with Christians at Jerusalem? What was his relationship to Christians in Caesarea? When he was in prison for 2 years, where was Silas? What was Luke doing during that 2 years? Where's Timothy? Where's Barnabas? And you look at those things and you find out that they apparently were not there. Then with Acts 27, we are probably getting ready for where Paul is going to end his ministry on earth. And if you keep your finger here, go to 2 Timothy 4. 2 Timothy 4. In Acts 27, during the Caesarean imprisonment for 2 years, we are probably beginning to see the beginning of the end for Paul. And the end for Paul was very simply, Paul died without any friends present. I think we can safely say, as this man took his last breath, there was nobody there. Now, I don't mean that necessarily to reflect on Luke, to reflect on Timothy, or to reflect on any other. But a simple fact, everybody left Paul in the last analysis. And so it could be very well during this 2-year period of time when we do not see Barnabas, we do not see Luke, we do not see any of Paul's companions, that we're now beginning to enter the doorway to 2 Timothy chapter 4, coming down to verse 9. He says, "Make every effort," and this is Paul's swan song, "make every effort to come to me soon. For Demas, having loved the present world," this present world, "has deserted me, gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia." And the implication is that this is said with heartache. "Only Luke is with me." And then you come down to verse 16, the last thing we know of Paul. It says, "At my first defense," that would be the reading of his charges before the emperor, "at my first defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them, but the Lord stood with me." So Paul is going to die without friends. Even those that uphold the doctrine he teaches, they still forsake Paul, and his parting words, sad words, are simply those words that all deserted me. And I do not say that to be negative about Luke or these other men, but Paul does say, everybody quit on me, and he's left all by himself. Now going back to Acts chapter 27. Do you remember somewhere in school of being asked in an English class to do different kinds of writing? And one of the kinds of writing you're asked to do is descriptive writing. Acts 27 is the most vivid piece of descriptive writing in the New Testament. And it deals with Paul in his shipwreck in his road to Rome. So let's put down again our first block is going to be Palestine to Crete. He leaves Palestine and he goes to Crete. And that's Acts chapter 27, 1 through 12. And when it was decided that we, and now after 2 years, this is the first time that we pick up one of the we sections in Luke, or in Acts. The we sections means Luke was along. And so how many people are wrapped up in that we do not know. We know that there were three. We know the we includes Paul. We know it includes Luke, because he's going to give us essentially his diary. And we know it also included Aristarchus. How many more, we do not know. But this is going to be eyewitness account. The number of we leave with those three at least, plus prisoners. We do not know how many prisoners, we're not told, plus a centurion of the Augustan cohort. What was, or what is meant by this Augustan cohort? The Augustan cohort, almost all of your military in the Roman army were associated with some division of the army. The Augustan cohort is a designation, and I'll write the Latin word they used, S-P-E-C-U-L-A-T-O-R-E-S, speculatores. And they were a special unit. They were not attached to any other type of a division in the Roman army. They were elite. They were unique. They were their own. And therefore, we have now sailing out a special forces individual. We have Paul, Aristarchus, and Luke. And you have a bunch of prisoners. And now we're off for sea. So we begin with, number one, the companions. Parenthesis, we have a new we section, meaning eyewitness account. And then we have to focus on the ship. Verse 2. The ship was designated by its home port. It says, and embarking on an Andromedian ship, which was about to sail to the regions of the coast of Asia. Remember Adramidium? We had it farther back in Acts. Over here is Asia. Over here is Europe. The connecting port was over here, Adramidium. It connected Europe with Asia, or really connected the east with the west in the northern part up near the Black Sea. And the ship has been there. It was a coasting vessel that was going to make stops along the way on the way back. It has unloaded its cargo and is apparently available for passengers. And Paul and his companions are going to sail about 500 miles in this particular ship. And then they're going to get on another ship. And it will be the wildest, wildest shipwreck you've ever seen. If you can picture what's going to happen, well, and I always have to label these maps because you wouldn't know otherwise. Okay, they're going to leave probably Caesarea. And they're going to stop at Sidon up here and sort of hop across the coast until they get to a place named Myra. Up to that point, everything is going to go fine. It's going to be very smooth. and the ship is fine. Over here, they change ships. And they change ships, and it's going to be one that is going to... I've got Crete misaligned here. It's going to be one that is headed for Rome. And up here at a place called Fair Havens, Paul is going to say, don't go. It was right in the middle of the season when sailing was extremely dangerous. And he's going to say, don't go. And he's going to also be very human. And it's one part that I really like in Paul because he says something that we all like to say. He said, don't go, it's going to be trouble. They go and it's trouble. And what is Paul's first words he spoke? I told you so. I love it because he makes it one with us. At any rate, they're going to sail from here down underneath this island. Paul pleads them not to go any further, and they decide that on Crete, over here on this part of the island, if we could make just one more hop, things would be fine. And as they consider it, Paul says, don't. The pilot and of the ship says, well, let's give it a shot. I think we can make it. They get up, and there's a beautiful, warm breeze from the south. It looks beautiful. And so they say, let's go. They come down, and I can't show it on the map, but right about at this point, there's a little a cape. Everything went fine until they got to the cape, and when they turned the cape, they caught Euroclydon. Euroclydon was a well-known, fierce wind. And when they cross the cape, that wind hits them. They can make no progress whatsoever. And down here is the coast of Africa. They want to go right here. Just a matter of not many miles. They want to go here. The northeast wind hits them coming out of here. And it is so fierce that they end up blown this way backwards. And I think you know if you're in a ship or an airplane and you're going backwards, that's not good. I remember once flying down to Siloam Springs in a super little airplane and got down on by Harrisonville on the road and noticed that cars were passing me, which means you probably have a headwind. And turn around, got home quick, but nonetheless, this is what they're seeing at this particular point, and they can make no progress. They finally throw everything out. They try to anchor the boat here because they are sure if they don't, they're going to end up on the sandbar down in northern Africa. And so this is going to take a period of 2 weeks. They're going to give up to the point that we surely cannot live through all of this. If you happen to be, by the way, and I'll give it to you now, if you happen to be interested in sailing or in some of the details, there are two outstanding books. One by Ramsey called St. Paul the Traveler. Sir Ramsey knows a great deal about the Roman Empire in the first century. Gives some good information on that. This one I don't think is available, but it's written by one who has navigated for about 20 years on the Mediterranean Sea. And what he does is point out the enormous accuracy of the nautical terms, the descriptions found in the book of Acts. And it's The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul by James Smith. But he's expert on giving chapter 27. Chapter 27 is full of technical, nautical terms, but it is a very descriptive one that is set in front of us. Okay, well, let's look down then to the itinerary. What is the itinerary beginning in verse 3? And the next day, we put in at Sidon. And that's... They probably came out of Caesarea. That's where he was imprisoned. He could have come out of there. There was a harbor at Caesarea. So if they do, they come out of Caesarea. They sailed north, and in verse 3, they came up to Sidon. The next day we put in at Sidon. Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Just a little note at this point. This man was a centurion. And one of the interesting things about centurions in the New Testament, they always receive considerable favor and are treated favorably. Let's go to the first one we ever meet, Matthew 8. Matthew 8. Verse 5. In fact, the centurion's faith is made a symbol of the faith of Gentiles that are going to come to know Christ. Chapter 8, verse 5. When he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him. This is the first encounter of Jesus with a centurion. Centurion, a commander over 100 Roman men. And saying, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering great pain. And he said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, and soldiers under me. I say to this one, go, and he goes. To another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus said this, he marveled and said to those who were following, truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. And so right at the beginning of his ministry, the first centurion he meets, he says, I note this man's faith. I have seen nothing like it in Israel. Furthermore, his faith is prophetic. And I say to you that many shall come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom shall be cast out, that with reference to Israel, into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so you have a very favorable account. Who was the next? Well, not the next necessarily, but going into our book of Acts, chapter 10. And we have now the opening up for the first time of the gospel to the Gentiles. And Acts 10:1 says, there was a certain man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man. This is a centurion now, a Roman soldier. Devout man, one who feared God with all his household, gave many alms to the Jewish people, and prayed to God continually. So notice we have another favorable opening door now into the Gentiles, and it is through a centurion that this occurred. Now, when they stop at Sidon, a church had been established there, and on the way back to it, stop at Acts 11. Acts 11. And note that because of the persecution of Stephen, a church had been established in Sidon, or in that area. In Acts 11 and verse 19, so then, those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia. And Phoenicia is the area in which Sidon is. And therefore, going back all the way to we know why the church was at Sidon, because the persecution had scattered believers, so we know how it started. We also have a pretty good idea of why the centurion was gracious to Paul and says, go on in, meet with your friends, I'll be good to you. And that would be found by stopping at Acts 24 on the way back to Acts 27. 24:23. Felix, with Paul in prison, gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet have some freedom, and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. That's probably what explains Acts 27 and verse 3. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius, that's the centurion, treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. That probably reflects the benevolent attitude of Felix that is now going to accompany Paul. Well, from there they go to Myra. Verse 4, from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. Now, that does not mean, when it says under Cyprus, it simply meant when they go under an island, to go under was to go leeward. Be the lee side. The lee side is the side protected from the wind. So if the wind is coming from the south, that's the lee side. If it's coming from the north, that would have been the lee side. They kept under the protection of the island, is what he's saying in in verse 4. And by the way, as we come through these verses and take a look at them, for spiritual excitement and thrills, do you see anything? The next day we put in at Sidon. That's geography. Julius treated Paul with consideration, let him go his friends and receive care, which is friendship, and that's nice. From there we put out to sea, sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, but the winds were contrary. And you begin to look through this, and by the time you get to verse 4, many of the interpreters of Acts 27 begin to get uptight. Because you look through here, and this is a sailing journey. This is really not spiritually exciting. They dumped all the wheat over. Nice. They threw everything out of the ship. Nice. And you see, you go down to verse 18, the next day we were being violently storm-tossed. They began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. And let me tell you, knowing that they threw the tackle over with their own hands and they jettisoned the cargo is tremendously strengthening spiritually. I mean, there's something for you to hang on to all week. You get under pressure. Remember, they jettisoned the cargo. And you say, well, that really isn't there, is it? Well, that's why you have so many wild interpretations of Acts 27, because you look at it and it's just not crammed with spiritual content. And therefore, in order to get it there, many interpreters, and I don't think they're really interpreters, will do what with the passage? When you can't get a blessing out of the plain meaning of a passage, what are you tempted to do? Spiritualize it. And so you can read many accounts that say Acts 27, if you read beyond the deeper meaning of throwing over the cargo and all of these things that they did in this, if you go deeper, you will find the journey of the Christian life. And having said that, you're now deeply interested. Well, I can't do that. The text means what it says. And if that is the case, then why did the Holy Spirit, and this is equally, the fact that they jettisoned the cargo is just as inspired as, therefore being justified by faith, we have peace with God. And while the spiritual content may be the same, it is equally inspired and equally true that the Holy Spirit meant for it to be here. He intended for it to be here. So, we could obviously make a ask question of why. And I think the point very simply here is this. Christianity is not a mystical religion. Christianity is a time-space, and I hate to use this word because it's so misused, but I think you know what I mean. It's a time-space religion. Christianity is not burning candles. Christianity is real men in a real boat protected by a real God. Christianity is not incense. It's a man of God that gets out in the middle of this storm and wonders, how are we ever going to make it? And when he says, how are we ever going to make it, God basically does nothing. And they sail, they despair of life, they get to the end of their rope, and there'll be some great lessons that are involved in that. But bear with me as we go through the text and look at these things, and I'll try to give you a spiritual thrill at the end if I can. The whole thing of Christianity, salvation, it came through a birth of a man at a place at a certain time and under certain conditions. And that's what distinguishes Christianity from other world religions that have nothing more than mythology, have nothing more than performance, who have nothing more than ritual. Christianity is time-space. It's God who is real at a particular time, at a particular place, doing a particular thing that is highly significant. That's the kind of religion we have. Christianity is historical type of religion, and that is much what this comes across with. Well, at Myra, and we're coming down now to verse 4. From there we put out to sea, sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we sailed through the sea along the court of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. Notice the time, space, history, real stuff, emphasis. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy. The Alexandrian ship, and I think it's important to recognize that there was an established relationship between Egypt and Rome. And that was called corn and grain. And there were ships that were contracted to continually bring in. In fact, think of it this way. Rome is out here, Egypt's down here. The granary of Rome was Egypt. They had to have corn. They had to have wheat. And one of these ships is at this particular point, and it was anchored at Myra in this context. Now, when you come down to verse 6, there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. And when we sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. And with difficulty, sailing past it, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, which was the city of Lycia. And if we go back to our map or map-like diagram, we're down here to Fair Haven, and the proposal is, this is a lousy port, better accommodations up here at Phoenix. And here we have the difference of opinion between the two men. And verse 9 says, when considerable time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous. Now, there's more significance to that than we might think, because we have a lot of naval information, merchant information that's dated in this particular time. And they listed the dangerous season, when it was unwise to sail. And that was September 14. And they had it down that close. And the last part of the dangerous season was November 11th. After 11th, insanity. They even say that. You're insane to get out in the Mediterranean Sea after the 11th of November. The winter continued and was continued over. It went from, to them, November 11th until sometime in early February. Nobody sailed. They left Fair Havens, and that's probably the explanation of the verb, of the word in verse 9, it was now dangerous. It was now dangerous because it's dated by the Day of Atonement in Jerusalem, and according to that, they sailed about mid-October. Now you can see they're going right in the middle of the dangerous season that they're going to sail. And so, Paul gives advice. Verse 10, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. And so Paul's prediction is very dire. He warns them, however, coming back to... by the way, I think Paul's advice is an excellent illustration of a balance between the sovereignty of God. If you look at Acts 23 and Acts 27, go back to Acts 23... verse 11. Acts 23, verse 11 is an important verse because it tells us about something about the way Paul viewed God's sovereignty and his responsibility. And how does it, we said before in our previous lesson, that the New Testament never recognizes tension between God's sovereignty and human responsibility. And if you come to chapter 23, verse 11, and let's call these truths A and truth B. Truth A is God is sovereign. Truth B is man is responsible. And let's go to truth A. Truth A is found in Acts 23 and verse 11. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood by his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness to Rome also. Is that saying he's going to make it to Rome? I take it is. He's going to make it to Rome. And therefore, Paul, again, let's say Paul grasp that truth, and I'm sure he did. But let's say he took, going back to our previous study, path one and said, well now, since I'm going to Rome, nothing can get in the way. And therefore I can dance on the ship, I can climb the mast, I can try to jump off, but it'll never succeed because I'm going to Rome. How do I'm going to Rome? God said so. Did he treat it that way? What do you look at? And look at Acts 27. In verse 10, where we've just been. Paul said to them, now he knew he was going to Rome. God already told him that. But notice, he balances this out now with, we better not sail in bad weather. He was balanced out. The responsibility was there. And he said to them, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage, with great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now, is Paul consistent? Don't you wish you could come in and say, Paul, you're forgetting doctrine. Don't you remember what God said to you back in chapter 23? He said, you're going to Rome. So, how could your life be lost? Well, what do you say? All you can say is Paul didn't seem to feel any tension, did he? Both truths were in his mind, and therefore he did not make the mistake of imbalance. So that if you put two things together, you would have it like this. Paul had a sovereignly assigned destination. Acts 23 that we've just read. And that's, was it 23, what was it? 23:11, okay. At the same time, he is asserting to them, the weather is bad, don't sail, we'll get killed. And that's called human responsibility. 27 and verse 10. And in his own thinking, where's the tension? In his own thinking, there is no tension because he believed A. He also believed B. And he didn't wallow around saying, well, how am I going to link A with B? He didn't have that problem. Only Christians today have that problem. Paul didn't have the problem, and if we're going to think in Pauline mentality, we shouldn't have the problem either. Keep going back to Acts 27. He's overruled. By the way, who was the greater risk taker? The man who believed in the sovereignty of God or the man who didn't? Well, we're going to find out the man who didn't was willing to take risks. The man who believed in the sovereignty of God was not willing to take risks. Because verse 10, he gives his warning, but notice verse 11. The final decision, it says, the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot. The Gubernistes, translated pilot, had two responsibilities. One, safe navigation, and two, discipline of crew. So crew discipline, safe navigation was his responsibility. By the pilot and the captain. The captain is probably the same man as the pilot. The word for captain means owner. I think you've got that in your, yeah, you do, in your New American notes. So the pilot or the captain, who was also the owner of the ship, decide that because, verse 12, the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision. Oh, boy. The majority reached a decision. To put out to sea from there, if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, same island, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. The next day, everything looks really nice. Starts extremely well when a moderate south wind came up. Supposing that they had gained their purpose, the majority opinion is confirmed, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close inshore. And so things go fine. All they've got to do now is round Cape, what was called Cape Matala. And when they round Cape Matala, just sit back on the deck and relax, and that old southern breeze will blow you right into Phoenix, just like we said. It's cool. Everything's fine. Well, as soon as they turn around Cape Matala, they hit a typhoon. And so you come down to verse 14. Before long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind, and that thing was so frequent that notice sailors had named it. They named it with a combination of a Latin and a Greek word, Eurykulo, as it would be pronounced in Greek, Eurykulo. And when the ship was caught in it, we could not face the wind. We gave way to it and let ourselves be driven again. So here is a violent. By the way, see the word violent in verse 14? The word violent in verse 14 we would recognize tuphonikos, Greek word tuphonikos, English transliteration typhoon. So we a typhoon rushed down, and it was a common one, so it had been given a name. And from this point on, we have an eyewitness description of the storm that follows. The physical impact is verse 15. When the ship was caught in it, we could not face the wind. We gave way to it, let ourselves be driven along, and running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, 25 miles backwards. They come around the cape. It is so violent that they're blown 25 miles backwards. And at that point, they began to take emergency measures. First, in verse 16, they pull the dinghy on board. Normally, ships today, the dinghy is usually, what, attached to the side, is it not? Or no, it's over the... Where's the dinghy go? Isn't it on board on the... Where is it? Anyone know? Okay, where... towed is the way they did it. It wasn't attached, it was towed. And so they're towing the dinghy, which would allow them to go from the ship into the island, running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, verse 16, we're scarcely able to get the ship's boat, that's the dinghy, under control. And after we had hoisted it up, they take the second emergency step. This is God taking care of Paul. God's going to take care of Paul. But I think one of the interesting things about it is Paul was taken care of in the midst of the storm. And through all of this, he could have easily said, "Where's God?" He did not, and that's one of the observations we'll try to make. But at any rate, in verse 17, they use supporting cables. Supporting cables is a nautical term that can describe one of three or all of three procedures. One, and their object here is to keep the ship from breaking up, either breaking its back through the or just the hull breaking open, the whole thing bursting. And they had three measures that are found underneath this particular word for supporting the ship. One of them was to take ropes and pull them under the ship, bring them over the ship, and tie them firmly. So if this were the ship, you'd be tying the ship together like this so it wouldn't fall apart. It was also used in a second sense that they sometimes would take, and here's the ship, tied like this. It was also used for tying it like this. So they would just start at the front and they'd begin to wrap ropes around the ship so it won't burst apart. And then there was another method, and it was also under this, whereby you didn't want the ship to break its back. And therefore, this is the ship, and from stem to stern, they would wrap those together, and that would give it stability. So vertical, horizontal stability that's there. Can you imagine getting on a flight to go to California, and you say, "What's that over there?" "Oh, that's equipment to hold a plane together in case we get in turbulence." You know, how comforting. But these things were common. They carried this sort of emergency equipment on board to literally tie the thing together. And so you come down to that second measure. Third, you come down to verse 19. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard. Verse 18, I'm sorry. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Now, here's the last straw. They lost their navigational equipment. That's horrifying. I remember once flying to Lincoln, and at 10,000 feet, the altimeter rolled over. Well, that's, you know, when you're in cloud, it's very hard to know where are we now. And it's horrifying. It's the only time in my life when I think I'd have jumped out. Might have had a better chance. But nonetheless, how did they navigate? Stars. They hadn't seen stars for days. And so verse 20, since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. And I don't see any reason to you for excluding Paul from that word hour. Everybody on board thought this was it and that they were going to be lost in the midst of the storm. Well, Paul now begins to describe some of the emotional toll on the passengers. Verse 20, since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small storm was assaulting us, from then on all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. And when they'd gone a long time without food. And I don't know why they went a long time without food, whether it was not available. We find later on that there was some wheat on board, so that it was still apparently available. Maybe with the tossing and the turning, they couldn't prepare it. What's another option? On a nice, well-appointed ship today, what happens to most people? You get seasick. And if you can imagine being tossed like this, totally out of control, probably the implication when they had gone a long time without food because they barfed it all. I mean, every time it went down, it came up. And that's a very strong possibility that is that's there. So with this, Paul says what all of us love to say. Okay, you guys, you wouldn't listen to me, would you? I told you so. And that's what we've got coming down in these verses. Because notice at verse 21, when they'd gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in the midst and said, men, you ought to have followed my advice. Oh, that had to feel good. You ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. So Paul reminds him, and his first point was, I told you so. And apparently he shared the pessimism of most of them. Paul had some experience too. Remember 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he's been in three shipwrecks, two of them before this. So Paul knew what he was talking about. And so, verse 22, into the picture comes not, I told you so, you didn't listen to my experience, but I can now give you something really solid because I now offer you more than my opinion. I offer you the Word of God. And thus, verse 22, and yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, stood before me, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. And so the words of verse 10 were uninspired. The advice of verse 10 was uninspired. The advice of this is going to be under inspiration. Well, now one thing for sure, and let's take another trip, another logical trip. What is the basis of saying, Paul, you're going to be okay and everybody's going to be saved? Well, the basis of it, is it not in verse 24, you're going to stand before Caesar? And so notice, he simply said that in the context that it's because of the care of God for you, you're going to reach Rome. You're going to see Caesar. Now, that truth means we don't have to be careful anymore about not getting in shipwreck. Look down at verse, some of them try to split and leave, the sailors. Verse 30, the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat to the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow. It's a faithful crew. Remember sitting in Greece on an airline, and here comes the three officers on a, I think it was a 747, and they're on the way up those steps, taking those beads, you know, pulling them down, counting them, and I said, oh, brother, I hope there's more to this than beads. At any rate, they try to escape, and notice verse 31, Paul and the centurion said to the soldiers, unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. Verse 31 is responsibility. and yet back at the vision of the angel had said, you're going to make it to Caesar. Did Paul bend those true truths and say, go ahead, get off the ship, dance on the bow, swim in the water, get out in the life tubes, it's all fine, we're going to make it there, God has promised. He didn't take that extreme. He took two truths. You're going to reach Caesar, don't get out of the boat, and held them in a responsible way as he does in this entire context. Now let me close with three observations. One, let's take time to write them out because I think they're important. One, God cared for Paul. God cared for Paul in the midst of the storm. Emphasis on midst. On the midst of the storm, not from the storm or out of it. God cared for Paul in the midst of the storm, not from it. And in so doing, you say, why did he do that? Why didn't he just save him from it? Notice in this thing, God gave Paul plenty of time to fear for his life. He delivers him. But he gave him plenty of time to be scared to death. Can anyone here remotely identify with anything of that sort? Does God ever leave you in a situation where you're scared out of your wits? Well, God delivers his own, but very often it's delivering his own. Why did God wait 2 weeks before he told him it was going to be okay? Why do you wait? Well, that's God's method. God often cares for us in the midst of the storm, but not from it. Two, God supported Paul with the truth that he was safe. God supported Paul with the truth that he was safe until his assigned course was over. God supported Paul with the truth that he was safe, protected, until his assigned course was over. And part of that course involved reaching Rome. And he said, Paul, I want you to support yourself on the fact that I am sufficient. I will take care of you until it is over. Third observation. Even for a believer as great as Paul, he needed repeated truth. He needed for the truth to be repeated to him. And let me just string the verses together on that. Remember, he had been told he was going to Rome in Acts 23, verse 11. He is told that again in Acts 27, 24. Why did the Lord tell him twice? Because we need repeated truth. Don't you ever get in a pressure situation, all the truth you ever knew is just zip out the window? And this is Paul. God repeated truth for him. And now, our Father, we're thankful once again for your word in Christ's name. Amen.